time for Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, www.freakradio.org, 91.3 FM in Olympia, Washington. My name's the V-Man, and on today's show, I'll be discussing unelected President George W. Bush's trip to the dark continent Africa, the land we hear so little about in this country. My guest is Jokey Jehu. She's the executive director of the 50 Years is Enough Network, and we're going to be discussing the true motivations behind George W.'s visit to the African continent. Stay with us. We got that coming right up next here on Free Radio 96.3 FM, Rockin' the Boat. Unelected President George W. Bush has been traveling throughout Africa since July 7th in what is his first official visit as president. He is scheduled to visit the nations of Senegal, South Africa, Botswana, Uganda, and Nigeria. With so many problems plaguing the continent, many Africa advocates are excited by the international media attention the president's trip brings to the region, yet are skeptical of Bush's motives. An article by Richard Stevenson in the July 9th New York Times newspaper reads in part, "In his 5 days in Africa, Mr. Bush will have few opportunities to see firsthand much of the poverty and despair bred by centuries of oppression, war, and disease. The relatively brief duration of his trip and the decision not to meet with more African leaders has also led many advocates of increased help to Africa question whether Mr. Bush's visit is more than a photo opportunity." That from page A8 of the July 9th New York Times. Today on Rockin' the Boat, we'll pose these and other questions to Jokey Jehu, executive director of the 50 Years is Enough Network, a coalition of over 200 grassroots organizations dedicated to the transformation of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund. Jokey Jehu was born and raised in Kenya, Africa, and she has participated in various global women's and environmental conferences, including the 1990 and 91 Global Assemblies for Women and the Environment in New York City and Miami, Florida, respectively. She is a founding member of the International Council of the World Social Forum and has participated in the World Social Forum since its 2001 inception. And Jokey Jehu is also a founding member of the Africa Social Forum. She currently lives and works in Washington, D.C., where she joins us by telephone tonight on Rockin' the Boat. Jokey Jehu, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me on.
The 50 Years is Enough Network was founded 9 years ago in 1994 on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the founding of the World Bank and IMF. Tell us a little bit about the focus of the network and how it came together.
The network focuses on the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and also some on the World Trade Organization. We were founded at a time when the World Bank and the IMF were telling a very different story from the one that most people had experienced about their policies, their programs, and their projects around the world. The World Bank was taking out full-page ads in the Washington Post, New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, talking about how great they had been for development. And at the time, people around the world, not just in the United States, but people around the world, in India, where hundreds of thousands of people had been displaced because of World Bank dam projects, in China, in Brazil, where indigenous peoples had lost their homelands, their livelihood, and their culture to make way for World Bank-funded roads to provide access to oil and other minerals in across the African continent and in other parts of Latin America, where structural adjustment programs, privatization, deregulation, cuts in spending for health and education, all of those things had wrecked havoc in the lives of people, and they wanted that story told, and that was how the 50 Years is Enough campaign was founded. It was a media campaign that became very, very successful in putting a different face of the World Bank and the IMF in the media alongside their full-page ads that they were paying for. We continue to do the work that we do because we believe that given the power that the World Bank and that the U.S. has at the World Bank and the IMF, the people in the United States need to understand what is being done in their name and with their tax dollars, the privatization, the deregulation, the denial of basic services like healthcare and education and food security and safe access to safe water are all done in the name of U.S. taxpayers. And we believe that if people know the truth, if people are exposed to the reality of what that means, that they will speak up and they will stand in solidarity with people around the world who are fighting back. So that's who the 50 Years is Enough Network is. And we do all kinds of things. We do public education. We do mass mobilizations. We do speaking tours and all kinds of other things that bring people face to face with the people who live the reality that I'm describing from all over the world, from Latin America and the Caribbean, from Asia Pacific, from Africa, but also actually from across the United States, where structural adjustment programs have, in the words of Malcolm X, come home to roost, as we see the cutbacks in Head Start and Medicare and Medicaid and privatization attempts of all kinds of things. We work with people in the U.S. as well, because those policies are being implemented here, not at the behest of the World Bank and the IMF, but because their ideology also permeates the people who make decisions in the U.S.
Well, clearly the U.S. is driving the policies there. And with Bush in the continent of Africa, it brings media attention there. And maybe we can talk about how some of those policies have affected Africa specifically, as many African nations have a combined debt of over $300 billion to the World Bank and IMF. Can you talk about the specifics of how these countries end up in debt and what ends up happening to their local economy?
Well, the process that led to the accumulation of, you know, that kind of massive debt was in the 1970s, when they were, the world and the banks were awash with petrodollars. There was a lot of money being made, and it was easy to lend it with very low interest rates, but with variable interest rates. I think people, anyone who's ever had a credit card and had to juggle payments understands what this means. And for many countries, they borrowed at very low interest rates, and then as the oil crisis of the 70s, later in the 70s and in the early 80s, came into play, many countries couldn't, you know, the interest rates went up, and many countries could not afford to continue to service their debt. And in came the World Bank and the IMF in the late 70s, and especially in the early 80s, when, in fact, Mexico became the first country that almost defaulted on its loans. And the IMF and World Bank decided that they could lend them more money to continue to service their debt, but that required, those new loans required structural adjustment programs. It required economic reforms. Governments have to cut, and this happens and has happened in about 90 countries. And we see it here in the U.S. as well. The government had to cut back spending. So what do they cut back? Health, education, food security, access to safe water. They cut credit to small farmers, et cetera, et cetera. They also had to deregulate. As this was going on, that there's this idea of creating an environment that is good for business, which means that, you know, environmental laws go out the window, health laws go out the window, labor laws go out the window, and that creates, quote unquote, an environment that is good for investment. And we have seen this happen in country after country. Privatization comes in, where there's a massive transfer of resources and of wealth from the from public hands into private hands, into private corporate hands. So whether it's the water system or the sewage, municipal sewage system, the phone system, the electricity system, the railway system, the national airlines, all those kinds of things are converted and are privatized. And in many of these countries, not only are they sold at fire sale kind of prices, but in many of these countries, there are no people locally who have the means, who have the money to be able to buy those utilities or those companies. And so there's a massive transfer from public hands into private hands. This is what it has meant. People in this country, I live in Washington, D.C. We just saw in the last year the privatization of the last public hospital in Washington, D.C. that was in a neighborhood where there's no other hospital that serves the neighborhood compared to other parts of the city where there are, you know, four, and in one case, eight hospitals in one quadrant, whereas in this one quadrant, the last remaining hospital has been privatized. leaving about 65,000 people who live in the city, poor people without insurance, without any possibility of getting treatment. We see those kinds of things happen. We've seen the attempts to privatize water in Atlanta, in New Orleans. We saw what in California, the deregulation and the Enron scheme scam did in 2001 with the deregulation of electricity. Those are the realities that many people in other countries have been living for about 20 years. And that's why for the work that we do, not only are we trying to educate and mobilize people, we want them to understand that this is their fight as well. What has been going on around the world is coming around, and that the need to stand in solidarity, the need to understand that those struggles are their struggles, becomes really important.
I'm speaking with Jyoti Jehu. She's the executive director of the 50 Years is Enough Network, and we're discussing Africa policy and related issues. On the cover of the July 9th New York Times I quoted from earlier is a photo of a very stoic-looking George W. Bush accompanied by Condoleezza Rice and his Secretary of State, Colin Powell. They are visiting a Senegalese island which was once used in the slave trade. But we have to turn to page A8 to get any coverage of the trip and the substance of the story.
Mm-hmm.
What about the media coverage? Do you think they're missing this moment?
I mean, if you look at the New York Times, you will not get any kind of real story of what people are saying, how people are feeling. You just mentioned Gori Island. It's the westernmost point of Africa. It's also the place where millions, more than a million slaves were exported from Africa through this one particular island. It is a sacred place. It's a place where the lives and the spirits and communities were broken as people were snatched from their homeland and taken into the Americas in the slave trade. Millions died on the way there. Millions were brought to the Americas. And it is a real insult, I have to say, for many people that George Bush dares to go to Gori Island and make the kind of statement that he made, where he stands there and invokes the name of Phyllis Wheatley and Martin Luther King. I guess for him, African-American leaders have to be dead for him to recognize them and acknowledge their contribution, because he has for now years refused to meet, for instance, with the Congressional Black Caucus. But he is able to stand there and in full hypocrisy make the kind of statement that he made. He did not make an apology really for slavery in a way that is meaningful and begins to redress that grave injustice suffered by our ancestors and that continues to be lived out by many African Americans who live in the United States and other people of color. The immigrants who came through that route and the immigrants who did not come on the Mayflower have come to the United States and have suffered a very common prejudice and ways in which that to this day that reality assails their lives and limits and becomes an obstacle in terms of what people are able to achieve. But, you know, he said all kinds of platitudes, and when you look at his position in terms of reparations for slavery, when you look at what his administration is doing at the World Trade Organization, in the World Bank and the IMF, in terms of trade agreements like the African Growth and Opportunity Act, you begin to realize that those were just words and they don't mean anything. And even his announcement during the State of the Union address, where he talked about $15 billion to fight HIV/AIDS in Africa, it very quickly became a global initiative to fight HIV/AIDS. Although after that, as soon as he made the announcement, of course, he got all the credit. And in fact, you know, here we are in the seventh month and none of that money has appeared. And in fact, that money looks like, one, it's going to be undermining the global initiative, the UN Global Fund for HIV, AIDS, TB, and malaria. And two, that it is going to be a massive corporate giveaway, because when they do the bilateral initiative, it means that all the medications, all the antiretroviral drugs that the U.S. is going to purchase to provide treatment in Africa and other parts of the world have to come from U.S. pharmaceutical companies. So in the name of doing good, in the name of treatment, treating people suffering from HIV/AIDS, which needs to be done and must be done, it also becomes a real bonus and a real win for multinational corporations, especially for pharmaceuticals. It's not an accident that the person appointed to lead this particular initiative is the former CEO of Eli Lilly, which is a pharmaceutical company. So we are paying attention and we are reading beyond the platitudes and reading between the lines, because for African people, they've been working very hard. As hard as they worked in slavery, they continue to work. Their livelihood, their resources are being taken away from them. But they're not sitting down and they're not, you know, giving up. They're fighting very hard. They're not looking for charity and they're not looking for handouts. They're fighting back, and what we need to be doing as people who care, as people of conscience, is to support African civil society, African peoples across the continent who are fighting day in, day out with very little resources, and all really they're asking for is for the support to succeed. George Bush could learn a thing or two. For your listeners, in June of 2002, there was a story, front page of the New York Times, in fact, bottom fold, where it talked about a village in my home country, Kenya, where this small Maasai village, a son of the village came back from Stanford where he had been going to medical school. And while in medical school, when he came back, he told his village what were the real facts of the September 11 attacks. And the people in this village, which is quite poor, were very touched on a human level and by the suffering and the loss in New York City. And do you know what they did? They gathered 14 head of cattle, 14 cows, and offered them to the people of New York and said, here, we want to contribute to your recovery. George Bush could learn quite a lot from these people, from the generosity of people who have nothing and by any measure, whether in the U.S. or in Kenya, are extremely poor people, but who responded on a human level, who responded on the sense that fellow human beings had suffered a devastation and they wanted to be in empathy. This is what needs to happen. It had nothing to do with what they would get back. It had nothing to do with the fact that someone else was going to make a profit off of it. It was about caring about the suffering and the grief and the loss of another human being. Human beings from very far, far away who they had never met. And this is a spirit of generosity. This is a spirit of human solidarity. This is what people need to understand about what is going on in Africa. Dick Stevenson in the New York Times talked about that Bush would never see the real Africa, the suffering and the problems that Africans are facing. By the same token, he won't see the women who are setting up orphanages to care for children in their villages, women who are involved in food security programs at the village level and at the family level, women who are doing tree planting to stop desertification across the continent, women who are fighting day in and day out for their rights and the rights of their children. He won't get to meet these amazing people across the continent who, with dignity and with their pride intact, still fight in the face of all the kinds of things and kind of oppression and exploitation that they face every day. That is his loss. And if he was going on something other than a five-day tour, a five-day safari across Africa, he would take the time to visit with people, to get to know them. You know, when he went to Goree Island, they woke people up at 6 in the morning and shut them out at a football field until he left. The residents of Goree Island were not even allowed to be in their homes. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of Bill Clinton or anything like that. In fact, they talked about this. We are not anti-American. We are anti-Bush. They said, when Bill Clinton came, he danced with us. He shook hands with us. He walked amongst us. But when George Bush came, they were all roused out of their beds at 6 in the morning and told to stay put in a football field for 6 hours until he left. He can make all the speeches that he wants about the tragedy of slavery, but there was another tragedy unfolding there. In the words of one of the Goree Island residents, they were treated like slaves all over again. And this is what George Bush doesn't understand. This is what Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell don't understand about why people are not happy to see them, why people are unhappy about U.S. policies. And everywhere he has gone, people have not said thank you for the crimes that he is offering. People have said, you are wrong about the war on Iraq. You are wrong about the International Criminal Court. You are wrong about the kinds of subsidies and positions that your administration is taking at the World Trade Organization. That's what people are talking about, because they're struggling and they need a chance to succeed. And none of those initiatives, none of those Bush administration positions at the international level are helping them. In fact, they are impeding them and they are becoming great obstacles in their struggle for justice and dignity.
You're tuned to Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm joined by Njoki Jehu, Executive Director of the 50 Years is Enough Network. We have about 10 minutes left, Njoki. And on the issue of slavery, I'd like to bring in the subject of what's happening with the conflicts and war in Liberia. The U.S. seems to be balking at sending any kind of real peacekeeping force to the region. They did send an advanced team, but can you talk a bit about what's going on there? Liberia, of course, is a nation that was founded by former slaves from the United States, and the U.S. obviously has a role in the history of the conflict. Maybe you can touch on that. And I do have a couple of other questions, so maybe if we can just
Sure, I'll be brief.
Thank you.
Well, what is going on in Liberia is a tragedy that has been going on, a civil war that has been going on for more than a decade now. And, you know, the U.S. has both a historical responsibility, because that it is resettled, Liberia was resettled by freed slaves in 1822. But there's also the fact that the U.S. has a hand in terms of that particular crisis. In the weapons that are being used, the U.S. had an alliance with the former president, Samuel Doe. And in fact, until very recently, they were not too upset with Charles Taylor either. And right now the U.S. acts as if they are innocent bystanders, or they're innocent parties in what is going on. In 1990, when this last flared up, what the U.S. did was they brought two Navy carriers off the coast of Monrovia, off the coast of Liberia, and they evacuated Americans and other foreign nationals, including Europeans, and left Liberians there to suffer and to be killed and massacred and to be put in, to be made destitute and put in refugee camps. And it's partly, and that situation actually kind of resolved itself with the death of Samuel Doe, who had been very much supported by the U.S. for a very long time. And it's the same kind of thing that we see now, that there's a little bit of a situation that I think they're waiting for it to resolve themselves, either for Charles Taylor to leave or the rebels to get him. Let me say one more thing about this. The U.S., you know, President Bush was candidate Bush, he made a statement where he said, at the time when that Condoleezza Rice that you're talking about was still an advisor to him, said that Africa was of no strategic importance to the United States. He is now, you know, flying around Africa for two reasons. One, oil. And, you know, he says that it's a kind of a conspiracy for anyone to bring this issue up. And two, because they consider Africa the weak link in the fight against terrorism. But he had said Africa has no strategic interest. Now he's changing his tune. But he forgot to give Donald Rumsfeld the new song sheet, because Donald Rumsfeld only last week said the same thing when he was asked on this question of deploying troops. And they are being asked to deploy troops to support the troops from the region, from ECOWAS. The ECOWAS has asked for the U.S. to send 2,000 troops in addition to the ones that they're sending, at least 3,000. People are saying, it's not for you to play a role on your own. We are asking for support, again, for solidarity. And that's what the U.S. needs to play. Bush keeps talking about how the U.S. is a leader. He talked about the reasons for going to war in Iraq, a humanitarian crisis, an oppressive and brutal dictator. And then the third one, in the case of Iraq, was the yet to be found weapons of mass destruction. Well, in Liberia, there's a humanitarian crisis of epic proportions. And two, there's a oppressive and brutal dictator. And so he needs to match his values and words that he has said in the past. But there is a way in which Africa gets left behind. Africa gets ignored. And I'm afraid that as much as I don't want the U.S. in Africa, it is happening again. And with everyone kind of, you know, sort of doing the ball back and forth. More and more people are having their lives destroyed.
So you say the U.S. is searching out maybe new military bases in Iraq to be placed, or to be placed in Africa, rather?
Oh, yeah, in the Cape of Guinea, where in the Gulf of Guinea, where there's a lot of oil. They are openly talking about that they look at Africa as replacing the Middle East as the main source of oil for the United States. It's right now, most of it coming from Nigeria. It's I think Nigeria provides that something like 17% of the oil consumed in the U.S. In Chad and Cameroon, they've built a pipeline that gets the oil out of Chad to the Gulf of Guinea, and it's going to go, it's going to get shipped to the U.S. Guinea-Bissau has a lot of oil, and they're doing all kinds of exploration for oil in the region. So this is what they're in that region for. When you look at where Bush has gone, he went to Nigeria, which has a lot of oil. He has gone to South Africa, which they see as a trading partner. He went to Uganda, which has said that it will support and stand by the U.S. position, the WTO, on the question of licensing and intellectual property rights on HIV/AIDS. And he's going to Botswana. And then he also went to Senegal because he wanted to make that symbolic presence. The thing that, there's so many issues besides Liberia that they're not talking about. The question of debt. The Bush administration has made the argument that Iraq's debt is illegitimate and odious because it was accumulated by an oppressive and brutal dictator. The same applies for much of Nigeria's debt. It was accumulated by Abacha and other military regimes before him. And in the case of South Africa, of course, perhaps the clearest example of an illegitimate and odious debt, the debt of the racist and brutal and oppressive apartheid regimes. But that argument, that logic, seems not to be able to extend to the African situation in specific or in general. And this is why we are saying he keeps talking. Now he needs to walk the walk instead of just talking the talk. He keeps promising money, and people in Africa are saying, show us the money. Not because it is charity, but because it's the right thing to do, and it is time for payback to some extent.
Njoki Jehu, we have just about 2 minutes left. Maybe we can end on how much you think your organizing has impacted U.S.-Africa policy, how much of the change you think is maybe rhetoric, and what can be done to keep media attention on Africa after Bush is long gone.
I think for your listeners, they need to visit our website, www.50years.org. They need to visit the website of Africa Action, www.africaaction.org. They need to go to transafricaforum.org. They need to get connected and to understand what is out there in terms of progressive analysis, a different story that you don't hear told by the mainstream media. They need to open their minds and their hearts to the rest of the human family and what is going on in the African continent. People, are not, again, looking for handouts. They are looking for support and solidarity. And for the people of the African continent, they have had very much to offer. This country was built by slaves. It was the blood, sweat, and tears of slaves that built this country. And those were people who were taken away from the African continent who did not get to work and to live there and to build that continent. And we need to recognize the responsibility of that. We also need to recognize the role that the U.S. has played, especially during the Cold War, in terms of the kinds of regimes that were supported across the continent, the kinds of policies that the U.S. is supporting at the World Bank and the IMF. These are the things that are going on. And the information about the reality, the resistance, the survival going on the African continent, it's not in the New York Times. You have to dig deep. If you look at websites like allafrica.com and you look at newspapers from Senegal and from South Africa, the coverage that you get about what was the reception and the issues that people were raising with Bush's visit, people even being able saying, we are not anti-American, we are anti-Bush, because we see him as a bully and we see him as someone who does not respect international law. There's a lot that we have to learn, and there's a cry out there for solidarity and action from people in other parts of the world. It is time that we responded. And I really encourage your listeners to join organizations and to support both organizations that are working at the international level and looking at the African continent, but also organizations here that are looking at the situation of poor and working people. And they're not just black, they're not just African American, they're white, they're Latino, they're Asian, and they're all human beings who want a chance to succeed. They don't want charity, they want a chance to succeed, and it calls for us to recognize the humanity of others and to take action.
We got to end it right there. Njoki Jehu, I want to thank you. You're the executive director of the 50 Years is Enough Network, 50years.org on the World Wide Web. Thanks for joining me on Rockin' the Boat.
Thank you for having me on.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And you can tune in again tomorrow from 5:30 to 6 o'clock for another edition of the show. Stay tuned to 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, www.freakradio.org.
Shona Malanga, Shona Malanga, Shona Malanga, Shona.